Welcome to Maya Matters, James from the Foot Collective. Welcome, James. It's so nice to finally have you here, and I know Samaya is going to be very excited to hear you on here today.
Thanks for having me, Tessa. It's great to be here.
It is super nice to have some other Queenslanders here as well, which is really nice. Now, feet are usually something people, they either love to know about or they just don't like being involved. It's either a yay or nay kind of participation. I think that's the clients as well as practitioners. The Foot Collective, though, is certainly somewhere where feet come first in all conversations. Talk me through first the Foot Collective and what it is about so we can get some context for people before I jump into questions.
Sure. Okay. Well, yeah, it was actually started, the Foot Collective was started by a Canadian physio called Nick St. Louis in, I think it was 2015. Whoa. And yeah, it just started as an Instagram page. He basically realized that his feet were all messed up from years in like cleats. He played rugby, so his feet were all messed up. And he realized that he had gone through physio school and not really learned anything about how to restore foot function. So he just went on his own learning journey, read a lot of books and did a lot of his own personal and professional development with feet and started the Instagram page, the Foot Collective, as like a way of just dumping what he was learning and spreading it out. And yeah, that obviously grew a fair bit over a few years. And when I started following, I'd been basically, I was across the sort of barefoot shoe movement and that kind of thing, but I didn't really know how to expand that or how else to look at foot function, even though I'd done a four-year physio degree as well. And so I really resonated with it, and I especially liked the aspect of like play and playing on balance beams and stuff. I'm a super sort of play kind of guy. So yeah, I really liked it. I got in touch with him, and then I started the Australian division, and then was just sort of running that part-time, I suppose, on the side. And then COVID, where I was operating my physio businesses out of, this is a long story short, by the way. I brought on my best mate as a business partner. We were living together at the time, and then we've sort of, the Australian division has basically grown more and more. We've started doing a lot of the, I guess, innovation in terms of the products and the training systems and everything. So now we've kind of become the hub of the Foot Collective, and then we've got our own little team. We now operate out of the Grange Bowls Club, which is pretty cool. And yeah, that's basically the story of the Foot Collective in a very small nutshell.
I love that. I think that's probably a story that a lot of people, like, they kind of see you in Australia and they assume that's where it kind of started and what it was. But no, that's a really cool backstory. And if you follow the Foot Collective, you will very much be on board with play-based training and play-based activities, which is really exciting because it just makes it so much more fun, right?
Yeah. Yeah. If it's fun, it gets done. It's kind of the way I look at it. Yeah.
Such a good concept. Now, why does the Foot Collective, why do you find feet so important, thus you've decided to come into an entire company that is about feet?
A couple of main reasons to that. One is obviously they are like, the feet are our foundation. We're bipedal animals. We spend most of our time on our two feet. They're our primary connection to the ground. And so the way that they move and the way that they absorb load and distribute loads from the ground will obviously have a massive impact on how other areas of our body experience and tolerate loads as well. So if our feet and ankle, like that whole complex, don't function well, then we won't be moving as efficiently. And obviously that especially goes for walking and running and jumping and things like that, but also as a, you know, strength training is a lot of it is on two feet, especially sort of more quote unquote functional strength training if you're not using machines. But yeah, if your feet and ankles aren't working the way they should, then all of the other areas have to compensate, and potentially that will lead to overload. Pain and injury is complex, but overloaded structures tend to be more likely to end up with pain and injury. So, you know, we like analogies, and the analogy we tend to give is the house. So if you're going to build a house or a building or, you know, a skyscraper is a good example, then you're going to start with a really rock solid foundation. Otherwise, the rest of the house is not going to be, or the rest of the building or the structure. It could be beautiful and strong and resilient, but if the foundation's shoddy, then it's not going to last very long. So it's the same kind of thing. Feet are our foundation. Let's focus on getting those right. And I think the other reason, which sort of leads on from there, is the feet are very tend to be very misunderstood and mistreated. So they just get shoved into these non-foot shaped things that we call shoes. They're seen as inherently weak and fragile. So it's like if they're not shoved into like high heels or dress shoes, then they have to be constantly supported and cushioned. And I think they're also a bit taboo. Like you said at the start, people kind of really love them or really hate them. There's not that much in between. But you know, people can think of them as either a bit ugly or stinky or something that just want to hide away. And then on the other end of that spectrum, you know, they can even be fetishized, and it creates a culture of basically like, well, let's steer away from the topic of feet and, you know, just keep hiding them away in shoes unless you're like into that.
We're in a whole nother program of like the self-esteem of feet right now. So it's like there's so many weird concepts that we like take all this magical care of our feet through squishy shoes, or we jam them into females into some pretty hectic shoes. But like, do we take the same care like for our poor little delicate hands or something like that? That is a really interesting concept about how society views feet and what they are about and kind of those myths that have been put around them, which is really interesting. And you said something before in terms of like, it's that connection with the ground. And I think it's really interesting to note that they are one of the only parts that we really have that constant feedback coming from beneath and from the ground from us, which, you know, like our elbows and stuff are never having that same connection and that same feedback to our brain.
Yeah. And that was one of the main things. Like, I went to Nick's first Australian seminar. He did a tour of Melbourne, Brisbane and Sydney, and I went to all of them because I'd sort of started the Australian thing. I was like, I'm just going to learn as much as I can. And one of the biggest things in the first seminar, he was like, our feet are primarily senses. And it's sort of like, I was like, oh yeah, that's true. That makes sense. And then later on, I was staying with a mate and there was a park outside and I was just standing on this rock. And I was like, yeah, they're senses. And I was looking down at them and they're just like hands, like they're just weird shaped hands. And they're sending all of this input back to your brain about the surface and the texture and the angles of the ground and all of this very important information. And as we know, like better input or better information, sensory processing equals better output from like a movement perspective. So, you know, it's just like with eyes, like if you're trying to walk around an environment and you're getting really good visual feedback, then you're going to navigate that environment a lot easier, a lot safer. And so eyes are an important sensor, feet are an important sensor. So wearing these big cushioned thick shoes around your feet eyes is like walking around with a blindfold, and like, yeah, you're much more likely to end up with issues.
Yeah, and that's kind of my next question. I know we so often as therapists or practitioners, we have clients that will come to us. They may be runners or they may just be, you know, our weekend warriors that are like, well, they may actually be getting a little bit more mature in their life. And the first question we often get asked is like, oh, my shoes are really dodgy. I need to go and get better shoes that are really cushioned to support me. Or, you know, why are you wearing flat ballet flats? Like, why? They're not good for your feet. You shouldn't be standing in them all day. So I guess the question I have for you is, society has been brought up very much, you know, as children, we get you supportive shoes as children so you can play around at school all day. When you go into your sports, we get you really supportive shoes so they're not taking too much force. What, I guess, effect has that contributed to our current care of our feet? Like, how does that contribute along in that concept of putting them in those very supportive shoes and making sure that that's that kind of concept we're running with? How does that then affect our feet eyes?
Yeah, it's such a interesting phenomenon that, like, the culture around supportive shoes. And you're right, the supportive shoes have kind of become synonymous with good shoes. So people say it in the same sentence, oh, I really need to get some good supportive shoes. And you see that around everywhere. And it's a bit nuanced because, yes, supportive shoes can be helpful tools in certain contexts, especially when, you know, something like an acute injury and things like that. But I like to actually told this sort of hypothetical story or analogy on one of our recent podcasts on flat feet. And it's interesting when you think about footwear as clothing, because we don't really think about it as clothing. We just see it as shoes, but it is technically clothing. And clothing was essentially an invention to help protect us from different aspects of the elements, whether it's, you know, too much sun or too much cold, or armor is another, essentially like a very heavy duty clothing to protect you from stab wounds and stuff. So it's, you know, it's a helpful invention, and footwear goes on the same way. You know, there's things in an environment, a natural environment, like thorns and thistles, and whether it's really cold environments or really hot environments, then having footwear is a great protection, just a layer of protection. But until we invented that clothing, our feet did absolutely fine supporting themselves from a musculoskeletal point of view. It's just the layer of protection really for our skin that we wanted. I like that analogy of footwear as clothing. And if you go back to this hypothetical scenario of, say, in the 1800s, when the industrial school system started, kids were sitting in chairs basically all day to learn academic things, maths and science and all this. And someone was like, wow, all these kids can't maintain a perfect upright posture all day. So in their chair, and they're slumping. And so, wow, we really need to give them some supportive clothing, like that. Maybe the corsets were fashionable at the time, and like, well, maybe we can do like a version of a corset for them to keep them upright in a neutral spine position all day. And that maybe that idea spread and became part of the school uniform. It's like, now the schools, if you come into school, you need to have this supportive clothing so that you can stay in this sort of quote unquote perfect neutral spine position. And kids would probably start wearing that younger and younger. It'd become the fashion. And so all of these kids then, with their extremely malleable developing bodies, would be restricted in their spinal movement, not just from the chairs, but also from this supportive clothing. And maybe they would still be able to walk and run and jump and climb and do those sort of natural movements that kids love to do, but they just wouldn't be moving their spines in the same way. And so that would alter the movement at their hips, that would alter the movement at their shoulders and their necks. And over time, you would expect to see their spines would start to become stiffer, weaker, and less coordinated, because they're just not moving them as much through their natural ranges of motion. So these kids would get to teenage years or adult years, and if you assess their spinal function then without their supportive clothing, then you'd expect to see some deficits in their function, and a certain percentage of them might have some spinal symptoms, some pain, or it might be sort of going into shoulder pain, hip pain, because their spine's not doing the movement that it should be doing. So for those people, if you assess them, you might go, well, their spine obviously needs a lot more support. Like, if they're functioning this badly, they probably just need more support. But it's actually the support that caused the issues in the first place. So it's kind of like a negative cycle or a self-fulfilling prophecy, where if you think an area needs constant support, and therefore you give it constant support, then it does sort of artificially create that need. And so that kind of is the story with feet and shoes, except the version of the chair or the unnatural environment is just constant flat level ground with no uneven terrain, no rocks, no logs, no trees, all of that. Yeah. And then the arch control shoes and the orthotics are the supportive clothing. So yeah, like I said, it's not to say that orthotics and supportive shoes don't have a role, but I think the popularity of them is definitely driven by the fact that we tend to put kids in them very young, before their arches have fully developed, before their feet have developed strength and coordination and mobility. They tend to have mobility pretty early, but especially the strength and coordination. And yeah, it artificially creates this need, and then this culture goes, well, supportive shoes are good.
Yeah, and it's that similar kind of concept when someone like rolls their ankle or sprains their ankle, and they go, oh, you need to tape it, you need to put it in a brace, keep it in that. And it's that same concept of, cool, it has a place for a certain period of time, but are we then creating not only a biomechanical kind of change where that continues to weaken the cycle, but then we're also creating that mental change that it is unsafe without this on, rather than us kind of working towards training our brain to feel safe in those movements that, you know, are considered unsafe movements, like walking, you might be walking on rocks or uneven surfaces, or I know forever if someone rolls their ankle, they're like, don't go running on grass. It's too uneven. We kind of get this concept and this perception about grass being an unsafe place for us to be.
It's not that uneven.
Yeah, like, well, we don't live in that much of a society. But I think there's a lot of people like, I was walking on the footpath, I took a step on the grass and that's it, my ankle went. And it's kind of like, you know, it's that constant cycle, regardless of where we're looking at it in the body. It's that constant creation of not only physical, but also mental and emotional connections to how these things are all connected to us and what they're about. A complete like shift of change for you here. And when it comes to this, look, it's a topic that gets everyone's grinds going. It's good old plantar fasciitis.
Oh, yeah.
Do you have it? Do you not have it? Is it a thing? Is it really? Can you have it for 15 years? And I assume you get asked this on a regular basis. However, I know many of our members would see people who self-diagnose themselves with plantar fasciitis. They think they need the socks online and the cool little vibration thing that does the things. Facebook does a great job at targeting these people.
Yeah.
What is your take, I guess, on the condition of plantar fasciitis? And then also would love to hear your management approach to these.
Sure. Yeah, it's definitely a very common question, probably the most common condition that we get asked about.
And yes, I can imagine.
I think the most common sort of painful foot condition, actually, plantar fasciitis. But yeah, we do. It's a rabbit hole, and we do have a whole podcast on this on our own podcast. But I can imagine
you've got a million of them.
Yeah. So yeah, it can get fairly deep, but I'll do my best to sort of stay concise and broad. And I do usually like to sort of zoom out on conditions in general anyway. But a couple of caveats to start. One is obviously, you know, pain is complex and multifactorial. Most clinicians and practitioners are across the sort of biopsychosocial approach to pain and injury now. So I don't really have to delve too far into that. But when you boil it down, most pain and injuries can pretty much be thought of as like a result of an imbalance between the capacity of the body to tolerate load and the demands that you're placing on the body. So obviously physical loads, mechanical loads are an important aspect of that. And we as musculoskeletal practitioners tend to focus mostly on that. But yeah, as I said, there's psychological factors, there's social factors that can influence the experience of pain. And I think that is probably especially when pain starts to become more persistent and more chronic, those factors tend to play more of a role. But it's you know, every pain and injury has elements of those factors. And like I said, musculoskeletal health, you know, I'm a physio. We deal a lot with osteos, myos, chiros, PTs, etc. So I think we can, you know, focus on the musculoskeletal aspect while also just acknowledging and educating the clients around the psychosocial factors. So that's one caveat. And two is the actual term plantar fasciitis. Obviously, that is what most people recognize it as and what it's been traditionally referred to for the last however many years, decades. But it is technically like an outdated term, the itis suffix being referring to the inflammation. And there has been some major studies that suggest that plantar fasciitis isn't actually necessarily driven by inflammation. It's more about a degenerative condition, basically, and changes in the structure of the fascia. But either way, I mean, it's kind of semantics, but it is important because if people see it as, you know, this constant inflammation, you know, in their tissues, then they might be looking at taking anti-inflammatories long term. They might be trying to do all these things to address inflammation when that's not actually even the driving factor.
Yeah, and even like the cold rolling on a cold water bottle concept, and I think it's a concept that still heavily gets driven for plantar fasciitis, and it's that what society views it as and still has that concept with. And I think that education is a huge part. So I think it's a valuable difference to know what the research is showing.
Yeah, definitely. And yeah, and it affects how you treat it. Most clinicians would be aware, but it's that sort of sharp stabbing heel pain that you get first thing in the morning, probably, or generally sort of warms up a bit with activity and may not really hurt during activities, but after a period of rest can sort of bite you. It's very similar to what's happened with the tendonitis versus tendinopathy distinctions lately. So it's very similar, and either way it's generally an overload or an overuse kind of condition. I kind of prefer the term overload. Loading the area too much, just from either doing too much too soon, like you've just got off the couch and you go and do a 5K, something like that. You know, that's
couch to 5K is not the thing.
Well, yeah. It's possibly good for fitness, but but yeah, musculoskeletally, it has its issues. And that is like a pretty typical presentation where someone's like, oh, I want to get fit. I'm going to start running. And oh, now I've got this heel pain in the morning every time. It usually comes on, you know, more gradually, but maybe at first there is some inflammation, which makes sense. If there's like an acute strain on the tissues, then inflammation being present is normal. But as the condition progresses and if it sticks around, then it makes more sense that it's more of a degenerative type condition. So yeah, there's either that sort of just overall too much too soon. Mm. And also what we tend to think about is like other areas of the body aren't doing their job and therefore there's too much load placed on that local area. So I would say you, in most cases, it's a little bit of both of those things. The body is an amazing compensator. I think if people just very gradually built up, then they would be less likely to experience it, even if other areas aren't sort of working as well. But when you have both going on, then it's like a perfect recipe.
We're just an impatient society, aren't we?
Yeah, we are. And so, yeah, my approach, a lot of it just comes down to load management. Obviously, load was the cause, some kind of imbalance in load, and therefore load management is a major part of the solution. And you can sort of think about that in two parts. I think I got this from Greg Lehman, who's a Canadian physio, but the non-expletive version is calm stuff down, build stuff back up. So, you know,
I like this.
Yeah. It's, you know, it's kind of two phases, but they can intermix, obviously. But, you know, calming stuff down, you want to have relative rest. And that is basically just avoiding the aggravating activities. That's your classic, you know, if it hurts when you do that, just don't do that. But it's just very important. That's a very short-term strategy. And as I said, relative rest, not complete rest, because you still want to have movement and some load going through the tissues to promote blood flow and healing. So there's that. There's like some kind of external support might be needed. This is a great case of when external support might be needed for the short term. So mm-hmm. whether it's more supportive shoes or orthotics. And that I really see that as like, because the thing with feet is you can't really avoid being on them.
It's a really hard thing, right?
Yeah. Unless you're going to go into a wheelchair, which is going to have its own issues, then, you know, it's not like a shoulder. If you've got a shoulder pain, you can just use the other hand if you're reaching overhead or whatever. But it's pretty hard to get around without your feet. And so that's kind of why I think orthotics became a thing. Is like, well, this person has to get around in their daily activities. So what can we do to offload or alter the load in the foot so that they can do that without aggravating the condition? So I think there's definitely a role for that. Personally, unless it's the case of like a pro athlete who has something coming up, I don't think that strategy should be used as a band-aid to be like, okay, well, you're getting plantar fascia, you're getting this pain after you do 10K runs, just keep doing your 10K runs and we'll chuck an orthotic in. I don't think that's a good strategy. I'd be much more on the strategy of like, well, let's drastically reduce your volume so that we can build back up without relying on those external supports. And in this calm stuff down phase, I would also add in there like massage and manual therapy, I think can be really good tools. In part, it's like a controlled load to the tissues. It's not the same as like an internally generated contraction, but it does provide some load and some nervous system modulation to just literally calm down the nervous system, the protective mechanisms that are going on. So that could be either to the plantar fascia itself or to the surrounding muscles and joints. Often tight calves can be a really good one to release. And, you know, it's different for everyone, obviously, but getting into those tissues and joints around the area can just help just calm it all down. And then, yeah, like I said, you can do some of this concurrently, but then the next sort of phase would be build stuff back up. And that would be looking at the sort of strength and load tolerance and mobility in the local area. So things like toe extension, ankle dorsiflexion, plantar flexion strength, and then also looking at the other areas up the stream that could be maybe not pulling their weight enough and therefore leading to that more of that overload in the plantar fascia. So things like your hip stability, your hip internal and external rotation, your hip extension, especially. That's like a classic example is because we sit so much, most people's hip extension is pretty limited. And so if your hip can't extend properly and you're trying to walk or run, then your foot and ankle are having to do a lot more work because you're not getting that efficient hip extension. So looking at all those areas and building them up slowly and concurrently. And the classic one for plantar fasciitis is high load strength training for high load calf raises with toe extension. You see like the fasciitis fighter, you can do it with a rolled up towel. Again, it's all individual, but that would be more towards like the end of, or closer towards the end of a rehab program when you're looking to get back into running. But yeah, that's pretty much my approach. Calm it down, build back up, and don't just focus on the local area. Make sure you're looking at the other areas as well so that you can. And I think, you know, if it was depending on the athlete or the person, whatever their goals are, you might have to do some more sport specific training as well, of course.
Yeah, and I think too, like, it's as much as it's intricate and the time that it takes for us to do that, I think people try to overcomplicate it very much so in that concept of actually like focusing on calming it down first and then working our way forward, rather than on appointment one, we come in, we treat it, and then we try to load it straight away and wonder why we're not getting that kind of progression that we're needing. Yeah. It seems very simplistic, and I understand the depth that it goes to get those to occur, but actually focusing on those stages as you walk through as well. And I think something that you mentioned that gets very much overlooked is that like big toe extension and how important that portion plays. And as much as, and you've said go local and then also have a look peripheral as to what else is occurring there, but I feel like people see plantar fascia and heel and the arch of the foot and forget there's these little toes that extend that portion, that actually assessing like toe extension and then adding toe extension into some of our rehabilitation that we're working with is a loading factor to our plantar fascia and that foot as well. Do you find that toe extension or great toe extension gets missed a little bit?
Definitely, yeah. And I personally don't remember learning anything about the importance of toe extension going through uni.
I'm pretty sure we didn't either.
Yeah, like I hadn't heard of the windlass mechanism, which you know, is like a critical part of how the plantar fascia works.
Correct.
And so, yeah, I think it definitely gets missed by a lot of practitioners and even practitioners and also people at first might have a hard time believing, like, what do you mean? It's just like my big toe. Like it's this tiny little joint at the bottom of my foot.
Cut it off and see how important it is.
Yeah, exactly. And so, yeah, I think it definitely gets missed. And like I said, I don't necessarily have to go fully into the windlass mechanism, but yeah, the toe extension is a big part of like the plantar fascia acts kind of like a spring with the Achilles tendon when we're walking and running. And so you go into pronation, and this is something we talk about a lot, pronation being demonized, but you actually need pronation for efficient walking and running mechanics. So yeah, you go into pronation, that basically stretches, and then you go back into supination as you extend, and that puts more tension, allows the plantar fascia to act like a spring. And so if you're missing toe extension, if you're missing pronation, if you're missing supination, then the plantar fascia can't work the way it's supposed to. So yeah, it's definitely a big thing that gets missed. And also that sort of thought of like, oh, we only want neutral foot arch. And it's like, well, actually when you're moving, you really want both.
Yeah. And I'm kind of thinking like shoes that then people put their feet in that probably prevent a lot of that movement for them as well. Like, are you getting enough pronation, supination, and allowing then toe extension as well? Like, I know when I put some shoes on, I'm like, oh my gosh, I can't feel through these. They're quite stiff. I'm not getting the flexibility, but can just imagine how some of those are just preventing that actual action of occurring, really.
In modern shoes and all these high-tech shoes, they've got the arch control, pronation control. But they've also tend to have the toe spring, which is that little sort of front lip at the front of the shoe. And so that starts to act like a rocker. And so you don't actually end up going through that toe extension and using that windlass mechanism as you usually would. So yeah, it's a perfect recipe to, and I think a lot of what happens as well is people get used to doing their daily activities and their sports in these shoes that have that effect. And then they go for a big walk on the beach barefoot, because obviously you're going to go barefoot at some time, or you go down to the park and or you're just around home or you do something barefoot. And then it's like the barefootness gets blamed. It's like, oh, it's because you were barefoot. It's because you weren't wearing your supportive shoes. It's like, well, it's actually because the supportive shoes weakened you so much that your feet couldn't tolerate going barefoot.
Yeah, and I think that's totally the perspective we see happening, that, yeah, it's just a very warped concept of how it all comes together with feet and where the blame often gets put on these things and how they've developed in that direction as well. And I know certainly now in running, having the shoes that have that rolling mechanism forward for them are very much a popular thing to have. And we've all seen someone in clinic that has swapped over to these shoes and all of a sudden we've got a bunch of issues occurring. But
usually up the stream because it sort of cushions the whole area.
Half test.
Yeah. Oh, my knees are hurting now and my hips. Yeah.
And you're like, I can nearly tell you exactly the shoes you're wearing.
Yeah.
I think it's really interesting for therapists to begin to think along those lines as well as to how not necessarily just the shoes you're wearing, but how are we interacting, shoes, no shoes, our environment around us, and actually more creating a bit of a storyboard of what's occurring with our feet rather than looking at them in an isolated context of one event that has occurred.
Mm.
Now, as we finish up for today, if I'm someone that is like, I am that person that has lived in supportive shoes my entire life, what do you recommend I do today to begin, I guess, transitioning towards something that is more of a natural movement for my feet?
It's a good question. And again, it would be a general answer. You usually would want it to be individualized based on, you know, the person's restrictions and injury history and so on. But as a general rule, if you're very used to supportive shoes, but you don't necessarily have like a foot pain condition, that's a very, you know, irritable foot pain condition, and you can manage some time barefoot. Most people are sort of in that camp where they do a lot of shod movement, but at home they tend to take their shoes off and kick around and they're okay. So if you're in that camp, then just starting to very gradually increase your time spent barefoot. That could be at home doing chores. That could be going out. I particularly like going out into nature and brave the uneven grass at a park.
It's a scary thing.
Yeah, very scary. And just actually just taking that time to reconnect with your feet, going out in a park in nature, breathing the fresh air, and just like actually focusing on the sensations that are coming through your feet from the grass. Grass is perfect because it's very... there is little bumps and stuff, so there is some texture, but it also gives you that sort of a very slightly spiky sensation, but very gentle versus, say, like bitumen or gravel, which is pretty hardcore. And sand is another good one, and you'd probably want to start on like harder sand and then go to softer sand if you've got access to sand. But a park is fine. Starting to spend more time barefoot, and then I would add in doing balance training. So stability and like our foundation for stability is such a major role of the feet. And this is something I've been mapping out with our products and our training systems, is like, how do you get anyone, as long as you can stand up, how do you get someone challenging their balance in a progressive way, but that is also fun? Because I think balance training is really important and overlooked. And, you know, strength training sort of is becoming a lot more well known as like a very important thing. And you can train balance and strength at the same time. But I think, you know, incorporating a lot of balance into your training might even be like 5 minutes to start, and doing that barefoot and then starting to do that on a surface that isn't flat ground. So this is why we use like, we've got our tool that's the Soulmate, and we started with balance beams, but it's like such a simple thing, but it's just narrow and domed, but it forces your foot to act in such a different way and to adapt to that uneven surface. And so that's how you build that adaptability. So there's that, and balance training as well tends to be a bit more, or a bit less aggravating, or a bit more accessible than strength training. And I think if you start with some balance training, you build some stability, you build some confidence, then you can start getting into some strength training, things like squats and split squats and calf raises, tibialis raises, and just moving through some body weight type strength training. And then, yeah, depending on your goals, depending on what you're wanting to do, then you could look at adding in more load with external load or whatever. But there's a lot you can do just with body weight as well. That's something we're actually about to launch a new, possibly by the time this podcast is out, we might have it good to go. But with our training systems, we're actually going to open source all of that on YouTube so that people who get the products can use it very easily, or people who don't necessarily get the products can still watch and learn from the YouTube videos. And you can still, like, even if you don't have a soulmate, for instance, you could use a couple of planks of wood or a couple of rolled up towels, or even just flat ground is fine to start on. And if you don't have a beam, then you could just make your own. Again, a plank of wood is good to start. But yeah, we just wanted to make that as open and accessible as possible for people so that it's not like putting this paywall on fun balance training, because I think it's important to have fun. Like I said at the start, it's like I'm a big play guy, and if it's fun, it gets done.
Totally. And certainly, as I said, if you follow Foot Collective, you will see, you will hopefully be familiar with the Soulmate as well, and how enjoyable and fun it, and it kind of becomes like a game for it's the person that is doing it, and it is an enjoyable, fun thing. It takes you back. It reminds me of during like preschool or kindergarten, they take you outside on all the cool balance things and you get to do that halfway through your day. And I was like, why do we stop doing that and having fun in the things that we have? And I think it is, it becomes a nice, enjoyable process that people are still learning and being a part of as well. And just starting to, I guess, investigate those preconceived ideas that they may have and have probably lived with quite a few years, that they start to challenge those and see the change. And it always reminds me of, it was a doco I'd watched about a regular person becoming a tightrope walker across the middle of a mountain, and they had to essentially learn to increase the proprioception within their feet so they could feel the changes occurring within the tightrope. And a lot of the training was starting on different surfaces and moving through barefoot, so they're able to increase that sensation and proprioception that's coming from their feet to respond in a better manner. So it always reminds me of that it's really, yes, it's about strength and balance, but it's also about brain activity as well, and what's occurring and what's happening for them as well. So I think overall, it's just such a functional and beneficial thing for people to be involved in. And there's nothing better, honestly, than standing in fresh grass and your feet. Like, let's be real.
Let's be real. I do it every day and it never gets old.
You go to the park, you're like, I just want my shoes off. Or whether that's just you and I, clearly.
Could be.
Well, I want to say a massive thank you for joining us today, James. It's always super great to chat about feet, which is something that hopefully we start to break the weird foot taboo for people and they start to engage and question these things as well. So a massive thanks for coming and sharing all your knowledge around the natural foot movement for us and how we can kind of embrace it as practitioners as well. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you.
Yeah, it was fun. Thanks for having me. It was great. I'll have to maybe get you on our podcast sometime too.
Chat about my gosh. Yes.
That'd be cool.
We are coming on board. Thanks so much for being with us today, James.
Cool. Pleasure. Thanks.
Remember to hit the subscribe button and share our podcast if you enjoyed today's episode. Follow us on social media for upcoming professional development and events in your coming area. Thanks for joining us today. And of course, stay tuned for our next episode of Myo Matters.